In today's episode, I had the luxury of interviewing one of the most iconic real estate agents in Dallas, Texas. She went from zero to hero, and it only took her 20 years. If you want to learn how to have a Hall of Fame career, stick around. You don't want to miss this one. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Wallet Watch. I'm your host, Brian McCauley. You guys know Wallet Watch is a platform we put together to talk about mortgages, money, and real estate. Speaking of real estate, we have a special treat for you today. She is one of the best to ever do it. She is on my Mount Rushmore of real estate all-stars. I want to welcome to the show my friend and real estate badass, Julie. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. You know this is my first podcast.
I'm so excited.
It's been on my 2024 list of things I need to conquer.
And good.
Since you are the goal guy, how fitting that I'm here
with you. I love it. A ton to talk about. Before we get into it, in case people don't know you, don't know your story, tell everybody about you, like where you're from, how long you've been doing this business, all that fun stuff.
Sure. So I've been in it for 22 years. I got my license in the Washington, D.C. area, so D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And that was in 2002. In 2006, my husband took a job with the Dallas Stars here. He was in the front office on the management side, and that was the catalyst of all things hockey, brought us to Texas. I had had a few years, obviously, of real estate under my belt at the time.
Yeah.
But coming here, I had to start from scratch. I'd never been to Texas. I'd never been to a state bordering Texas. We didn't know anybody. And since real estate is a business of relationships, we're talking about starting at ground zero.
Gosh.
So, I mean, it was about as ground zero as you could get. And from there, I just built up my team from there and just, and I'm something I'm really proud of now.
Good, good. Well, we all know you went from zero to hero quickly, but you did an excellent job for yourself here in Dallas. You know, this market seems to be a different curveball every year. Like, I think since pre-COVID, we haven't had a normal market. We had the COVID market that was nuts. We had rates go up and things fall off. 2024 seems to be like semi-normal, but there's still a lot of curveballs. I want to talk about what you're seeing so far in 24, specifically to Dallas. And I say Dallas because, like, you know, most people that we work with or for are here. And, you know, Texas obviously is a great state. It's booming. Dallas is doing well. But what are you seeing so far, 24? What do you see from now, kind of the back half of the year?
So my prediction for 2024, it does seem to be coming true. And you've always got to be careful with the magic eight ball, right? You got a 50% chance of being right or wrong.
Right.
But what I anticipated for 2024 always was that we were going to have a first strong half of the year, maybe even 5 months. June is a little bit of a toss up.
Yeah.
And then I felt the back nine of the year, especially getting closer to the election, you'd see that give people a little bit of pause.
Yeah.
Whenever you have a presidential election, especially as contentious as things have gotten and the headlines and all of that, it just brings fear right to the forefront. And that sort of instability and uncertainty gives some people pause on big purchase decisions. And if we've learned anything over the decades, it's that the world does keep turning.
Sure.
And we have to remember that, but there is that anxiety of unknowns that makes people not act quickly.
Right.
So that's sort of the key. And I think that that is probably going to hold true.
It's, I agree. I think Dallas is a little better spot. Just, I think economically, politically, it's strong. I think also, like I always tell people, pay attention to the population growth. The amount of people that are pouring in here, whether it's personal or business, they need a place to live. And so their housing demands, regardless, and why people are still indecisive about it, they have to make a decision because, you know, they've got to go one way or the other. I do think rates will get a little bit better. I do think election years are always wonky. But I do think, you know, I think you're right. People are pausing, but at the same time, they have to make decisions. I don't think the correction was as bad in Dallas as people thought. I think people thought it was going to hit the bottom and it bounced a tad, but it's kind of already back up.
100% agree. And I mean, how lucky are we to live here and do business here?
I know.
Right? And just the amount of net migration into Texas as a whole and Dallas in particular has created the stability that we need for prices to hold.
Yeah.
Now, there's natural seasonal movement in terms of a buyer's sense of urgency. agency.
Right.
That always tends to be at a peak in the spring. Mm-hmm. And then it depends obviously on the market segment. But in the luxury market, in the summer, that buyer population dwindles a bit, because if you have enough money to afford a $1-3 million house, you also have enough money to get out of here when it's 100, 110 degrees.
Right.
So the buyer pool can shrink. And that's just normal seasonal stuff we see year after year.
Yeah. I am seeing right now, as we're heading into spring and summer, I'm seeing cold spots. I'm seeing 20 multiple offers, and I'm seeing three or four. Are you seeing the same thing in the areas and the clients that you work with?
100%, 100%. And I also think that there's sort of a reckoning of what people can get for their money where.
Right.
So there's a ton of market education that is happening behind the scenes right now with buyers.
Yeah.
And I think that's key to making a smart investment. You have to be educated.
Yeah.
And that sort of ties into some of the other stuff we're going to talk about just educating yourself and understanding the nuances of value in these different zip codes. But I do think the idea of doubling down on pockets that promise to become something is a little bit more risky in this current environment. I do think that doubling down on proven markets and proven neighborhoods is probably a little bit of the smarter play in the short term.
So speaking of proven markets, let's talk about proven business models. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years. You've been doing this for 20 years. We've seen a lot. We've been through a lot. Kudos to you for obviously staying on top and doing it all the way through. I think one of the pros and the cons of being Dallas and being a boom industry is sometimes it can give people a false understanding of the business model. What I mean by that is really most realtors or lenders are either transaction-based or relationship-based. They are fundamentally different. The relationship-based model is so much better, and it's what you are. Talk me through, you know, one of the reasons you obviously, there's many reasons you've been able to sustain and be on top, education and just, you know, connections, all these things. But because you're so relationship heavy, talk a little bit about that. What do you think the biggest difference is? Why do you think a lot of people pick the transaction model over the relationship? And how have you done so well in like keeping those roots with all your people over these years?
I mean, the transaction model, without question, when you're just talking about just churn and burn and you're not focusing on the people behind those transactions, that is survival mode all the way. Mm-hmm. So you have to decide if that's the kind of business you want to run. It doesn't seem like a smart long play. For us, it's always been relationships. And really, the more we have given, the more we have received.
Yeah.
And so that is a question of staying in front of people and, again, offering insight, offering education, offering contacts that you have, and just being resourceful for those people without expectation of anything in return.
Sure.
And that has just paid dividends beyond my wildest dreams. And I also credit coaching early on in my career for teaching me that. So anyone who is sort of at that point where they're either just getting into the business or they've plateaued, I do think coaching can be really great for a lot of people in terms of being able to see the forest through the trees and what the game plan is. And for us, the biggest sale I ever did was a referral from someone that we would just invite them to our events, and they referred a client from a friend that was relocating from LA.
Right.
And I'd never done business with that person, but they trusted me enough to refer someone to me. And that's what we talk about when we talk about just planting the seeds and then reaping and the benefits of that.
And I think for you too, I mean, you know, people work with people they like and trust. And I think the relationship part about you is obviously, you know, you're super educated, you're honest with people, you're direct. Your advice is pretty much spot on all the time, but also, you know, your connection with the stars and other people. And I think that breeds through others over a long period of time. And so when people think, hey, who knows what they're doing? Who's proactive? Who's a full-time person? You come to mind when it comes to the relationship-based piece. I know one of the challenges in my relationship-based business that you've probably witnessed as well, but you've done an excellent job growing in that area, is to be relationship-based and to cater to everybody is building a team. Over the years, you've gone from like a one-woman army rock star to like a pot of Avengers. And whether that be Frank, whether that be the other people on your team, talk to me about your team model, your concept and the growth. What gave you the idea to start it? How many people are on your team, and how do they complement you and clients, making sure that all those relationships are, you know, taken care of properly?
Well, first things first, when I was on my own and as the business really started to grow, that's really that's the HOV lane to burnout too, if you don't partner up with your weaknesses. Mm. In my case, I married my weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And so when Frank left the NHL, We merged, and what Frank does, Frank is my husband, yeah. and he runs our team. He's essentially the general manager of our team. So I've got two people on the business ops side, okay. and then I've got four people who, myself included, who are selling agents. And we brought on an intern who's in that 6 month period,
yeah.
see what he's doing, and then he will probably become a part of our team. But having someone on the business side, when you talk about the relationships, yeah. they also help you manage those relationships. Their job essentially, so Lindsay Tucker, who is our assistant for the entire team, she essentially is a client relationship coordinator. Yeah. So if somebody has a 1 year anniversary of their home, we're sending orchids or cookies. If all those little things that sort of make the trains run on time, mm-hmm. they're doing that on that side. So I always joke that their job is to make me look thoughtful,
sure.
right? Because sometimes when you've got so many balls in the air and you're working on the conversations, education, you're working on the actual nuts and bolts of real estate,
yeah.
running the business behind the scenes, it's such a healthy thing sure. to abdicate responsibility on that to make sure that someone else is overseeing that and making it happen.
Yeah.
And so that's essentially the structure of our team, business ops, and then selling.
Got it. So, I mean, obviously you're essentially the surgeon. You're in the OR a lot of the times. And so you need support on the back end to make sure the rest of it runs. And so Frank is obviously heading that up. Shout out to Frank. I know he does a great job. How many people are on your team total right now? Is it buyer's agents, seller's agents, marketing? Like, what's the count of people and who does what?
So that's a great question. So people don't necessarily specialize on just helping list or just helping the buy side. They do a little bit of everything. But as my business has grown, and especially since there's a lot of handholding on my side, where it's agent to meet versus just a Supra and just kind of pray for the best.
Yeah.
We try and meet these showings so that we can be advocates for the home and torchbearers for the property. Okay. And so what I'll do is when my bandwidth gets really taxed, and keep in mind, I've got two boys too, right? Yeah. So they're 8 and 10. So I get to parenting a little later. So sure. I'm an old lady with little kids. And I needed that support.
Totally.
I needed that support so that if I have a luxury listing and I owe those sellers the best of me,
yeah.
I have someone on my team who's effectively an understudy, so to speak. They mm-hmm. know everything ins and outs about that home, the talking points, all of that. And same thing on the buy side. And they'll partner up with me. And I will give them either a flat fee on the listing side or a percentage of the commission on the buy side. Mm-hmm. And then that person has two people that they're familiar with. And I've got all my bases covered that way.
That's good.
So they have their own businesses and they have their own clients, but they also operate as support for me.
It's good. How did you find those people? Do you have somebody reaching out for you? Was it a past client? Somebody reach out to you because your name and your brand, which we'll talk about in a minute, but how do you find those people for the people that are watching LOs or agents saying like, I want to do that too. Where do you find these people that complement and help you and the team and the brand?
So a lot of it is familiarity, where maybe I did a deal with that agent and I saw the way that they communicated. I saw whether they were dotting I, crossing T's kind of agents, right? And just were they on top of it? Mm-hmm. And do they fit in terms of, I mean, listen, Brian, at the end of the day, I'm a pipsqueak little smartass from New Jersey.
It's okay. Right? I love you for that.
And I've leaned into that. I mean, I am a direct and to the point. I try and protect people. I tell them what they need to know, not what they want to know.
Sure.
And I want agents. Everyone on my team is super different. We're all really different, but we complement each other. And so does the communication work at the end of the day. Because if they're great at everything, but it just, the vibe doesn't work.
Yeah.
I just don't think that makes for a cohesive work family, right? And so for me, it's mostly just being out there doing real estate, right? Learning how other people work. And if I think that they have potential to go to the next level too, and I could actually offer them something in that regard, then it will be a conversation that I throw out there.
It's good. What's the vision for you? You still want to go bigger and more? Is it, hey, you know, we're at a good place. I just want to make sure that we're super polished and everyone's happy and quality of life. What's that next 12, 24, 36 months look like for you and the team?
That's a great, great question. And Frank and I talk about that a lot as well. It's not necessarily just about expanding. Mm-hmm. It's for sure maintaining and improving.
Okay.
And if the right person presents, then I'm always open.
Got it.
If the right person presents, then I'm always open, but I don't have a need to grow.
Yeah. So you're not proactively looking for it, but if it presents itself, okay. But in the meantime, let's just make sure our team is A+ and we're just all stars and taking care of each other and everybody to the best of our ability.
100%. And I've got to make sure that I've got the foundation to serve the agents on my team as well. Because if you expand and you don't have the support and the structure for that expansion, then that just hurts everybody. So I try to be super mindful of that.
That's good. Why do you think agents, as they're growing, struggle to build the teams? It takes a long time, even for lenders. Like, everybody's a control freak and they have a hard time delegating, getting it all done. You've done an excellent job. Why do you think more real estate agents and or lenders that are trying to maybe go bigger and expand the team struggle so much with creating the right team and keeping it together?
I think that at the end of the day, it just sort of comes down to mapping out the whole course. And that's where coaching can also really help because you get another perspective. But I think it's about collaboration and about mapping out a plan, right? And I think people just get stuck.
Yeah.
And I also think, and I know what works because I've also made the mistakes along the way too. It hasn't always been like a straight line.
Yep.
I've made the mistakes too. I have hired the wrong people. I will say this, I've never, ever hired a bad person.
Yeah.
I've always hired good people, but the key at the end of the day is, are they salespeople?
Right.
Right. And those are things sometimes that you learn in the process.
Yeah.
But you've got to be smart. You've got to be smart about who you bring on, because again, the whole idea, it's like the same thing with running a team. One person who really can totally change the dynamic of a whole locker room.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing with running a team, is being slow to hire, quick to fire.
Yeah, I know. And people suffer from that office or that team terrorist that, like, you know, you've got five people that are great, one that's not running the play the right way, and it ends up blowing it up. So I think you're smart to say, like, hey, you got to protect what you're doing and make sure you hire correctly.
And writing things down. And that's where Frank is so good, because he was an assistant general manager for several different NHL teams throughout North America and understands systems and process.
Yeah.
And I can be a little bit more the 30,000 foot view. Sure. And he can get in the weeds and really works through process. And he enforces that on the team. Mm. And that also, at the end of the day, protects us. So one of the reasons people might have difficulty expanding is that they don't have a Frank.
They don't have an anchor.
That actually has an anchor.
It on paper to get it going and keeps the momentum there. That's good.
And the accountability part, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's funny when we bring that home, we're at the dinner table.
Sure.
Right?
Got it.
To talk about process. He's like, what's the process?
Well, and the good news is he's a rock star at it. He's been super helpful for you. So you guys are just trying to fine tune it to make sure it continues to roll like it's rolling.
And not that everybody wants to hear me talk about, you know, giving kudos to my husband on this, but I do owe him a tremendous amount of gratitude and acknowledgement, because I was really proud of what I built, but Frank took it to the next level.
That's awesome.
He refined it.
Good to hear. Frank, your wife loves you. That excellent job. Keep it going. Speaking of next level, I want to spend some time on branding and social. You and I both obviously have added this to our business over the past couple of years. It's helped me in a couple different areas. I know it's helped you a ton. Talk to me, I guess, first and foremost, what gave you the idea to transition from who I know you were behind the camera to who you are in front of the camera now, and you're doing so good with your social media, with your branding and your video. What gave you the bump to do it? And how's it been going?
So first things first, I am a product of the 80s. So I grew up with a dad who had that major sort of NBC camera on his shoulder for my whole childhood. So I do think I got comfortable in front of the camera at an early age. It really is a differentiator. Someone said something once about, for real estate agents specifically, or businesses in general, humanize to monetize, right? And so a lot of what agents do is they use Instagram or they use TikTok just as sort of a resume of, look what I've done. And that's great, but that gets really static and boring after a while. And I think people want to hear from you. They want to hear your voice, right? They want to hear what's your take on certain things. And so part of that has been a process of discovery for myself, just finding out what works. For example, I think this is a great example. Early on, there are some other agents who do really funny Instagrams or TikToks, and they would make me laugh. And then I think I tried a couple of those on for size, but it wasn't. I mean, I'm humorous in a different way, but doing voiceover stuff at the end of the day isn't really my true character.
Sure.
And you've got to find what works for you, and you have to lean into an authentic voice.
Sure.
You cannot You cannot pretend to be something that you're not, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes you learn that by trying it and being like, I'm giving myself all the icks.
Sure.
This just does not work. This is not me.
Right.
But she does it great. I'm going to let her do that, right? But it's a question of finding the mix. So my stuff where I'm so comfortable with is a mix of education and just saying it, just telling it like I see it, and story time, because story time can also be a great way to teaching a lesson too.
Yeah.
And trend analysis, what we're seeing, what people will pay top dollar for. And sometimes it's the harsh reality of what people won't.
Yeah.
And if I'm telling the truth, even if it's controversial,
yeah.
I have no problem putting it out there,
yeah.
right? If it is the truth, that's what I go by. And so like right now, for example, we're seeing sort of an expiration date quickly approaching on white kitchens,
yeah.
white on white on white, that mm-hmm. real static white and gray. And I'm not saying it's gone yet. I happen to have a white kitchen, right?
right.
But it's kind of like, listen, understand purely from a value perspective what people are paying the most for these days. That's why I want to educate people on pay attention to these trends, not because I'm trying to be mean about your white kitchen.
Sure.
I have one too.
Right.
But if you're paying attention to value, these are things you need to know to evolve so you can get top dollar at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what I try to lean into just in terms of the content that I do, is make it more educational, but a mix of saucy right. and funny.
Well, and I mean, you're authentic. People that know you're being authentic. People that may not recognize you, but they pick you up on social and stuff now, they can pick up really quick that you're not doing it for the views. You're doing it for the client's education component, and it comes across as authentic, and you know what you're doing. And I think in a world that's very noisy with a lot of cameras and a lot of things here and there, that is okay. But at the end of the day, like, people want people that are real. They want them that are authentic. And I always think, like, when they get done watching a video from you or me or somebody else, they should leave there with a nugget and a value and go, I appreciate that, and I want to work with that person. You do a great job of that, because education is a big component of it. Yes, showmanship is part of it, and yes, character here and there, but at the end of the day, you have to be told facts, and you have to be told what's right and lead people in a good direction. And I think for you, finding your roots now and knowing who you are and getting it done, it comes off so authentic and well, because it is you, but also it separates itself from the competition, which is like, it can't always be a funny, it can't always be a house tour. Sometimes a human says, like, give me knowledge and data and information and shoot me straight, which you do an excellent job of. So I can appreciate that for sure, because there's noise everywhere, and not all noise is good.
Not all noise is good. Not all noise is authentic. Not all noise is true.
True.
Right? And mm-hmm. that's been something that's been shocking. And it shouldn't be shocking, but it was to me, of how powerful the social media is.
It's powerful.
And what the reach is and the wingspan and how many people you can reach through it, certainly locally and other agents. But that's been something where people are like, talk to me about how your business has changed from doing the social media. What I would say is, you establish yourself as someone who knows what the heck they're talking about. And you also, can brand yourself as a thought leader
yep.
in that particular space. So where my business has most noticeably gone up is referrals from other agents around the country. Because when people hear you talk and they hear you pontificate on certain topics or advice or whatever, they realize that you're someone who could be trusted and you know their stuff. And so they'll hand off their client to you.
Yeah.
And that's been sort of the biggest game changer for me.
It's good. Yeah. I mean, you know, when it comes to impacting the business, I tell people with social, I mean, one, you know, you have to have a batting average and you have to have stats. And what I mean by that is, you know, people can do a good job being someone on social, but are they really that person behind the scenes? Meaning, if I get out there and tell everybody, hey, I can throw a 60-yard touchdown pass, blah, 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 whatever, and do a good job of it, great. But what people really want is seeing me actually do it. For you, what's great is that you articulate it well, but as you know, doing this for such a long period of time, you have the batting average and the stats to back it up. And I think in an industry where, for better or for worse, on my side or your side, the barriers of entry are low. So sometimes you can be a bartender and then you can be a loan officer and a realtor the next day and putting on a nice dress or a suit and tie and pop it online. It's a great thing because it gives people the opportunity to jump into an industry that's a gem and awesome, help a lot of people. But at the same time, it's very hard to separate all-star quarterbacks from bench warmers. And I mean that respectfully. But to your point, your social media and your video and stuff is a SportsCenter highlight of you. It has a very broad reach. People can get to it quickly. I think we noticed during COVID, like, if you didn't have an online presence, it was much harder to get your exposure to other people. And so now, obviously, that you're doing social and video and everything else, it's really, I think, you know, spread your wings wider. And it's nice to hear that not only does it impact, like, on your current clients and team and everything else, but other agents and other business people are recognizing you and coming to you because of that. Had you not done it, you'd still be kind of, you know, amazing, but not as many people would have known. And I still find too with realtors and lenders, some people still are against social or anti-social or not doing it. In my mind, I'm like, hey, we're in 24. I'm already working on AI projects, literally for voice cloning and things here and there in the future. Why do you think some real estate agents are still against or anti or whatever, like doing some type of video in social? Everybody has a weirdness when they get into it, but you fought through that. I fought through that. We're so much better for it. And our brand and videos have brought us a lot of eyeballs and clients and education. But why do you still think some people just won't make it part of their business just as much as a listing appointment or a phone call?
I think it just comes down to confidence, and it's challenging. I mean, listen, it's not always easy. And I will say, not to sound sexist, but especially as a woman, it's hard to see yourself on film. Sometimes we can be our own worst critics, right? But at the end of the day, people just care about the information that we have to share.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's a question of just kind of feeling your way around, honing that skill set. And I think that the more static presentation from a lot of agents where it's like, oh, check out, you know, Sue S had a nice review for me.
Sure.
Nobody cares.
Sure.
Nobody cares.
Sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's throw a little bit of meat on the bone. And the way you do that is by adding your voice to the mix. And I just think a lot of people don't have the confidence or they don't know what to say, which is really a shame, because the truth is, in your business and mine, every day provides us with content, stories, lessons, mistakes. I mean, it just nonstop, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's a question of embracing what you know, because you do know a lot and you do have a lot to share. And if you don't, then that's not exactly it's a seal of confidence, right, for
sure.
A buyer.
Yeah. I also think sometimes agents, they get scared and they're not sure what to say. And I'm like, you know, look, you can do it in the dark. There's no timeline. Like, you can start something in June, July, August, whatever, but you got to get going. I think a lot of people think two things. Yeah, judgment. They judge themselves. Like, I realize when I watch my videos, I talk too fast. I move my eyeballs around when I'm thinking here and there. Maybe someone judges themselves about the way they look, but the truth is, no one pays attention to our flaws like we're paying attention to. They're really paying attention to the story and the nuggets. I think once you get past that and then you see good evidence of success of, hey, I saw you talking about this listing. Hey, I saw about this loan product here and there, starts to build that, and you realize, hey, this is not what people are looking at my nose. They're looking at the nugget and stuff here and there. And then I also want people to realize, like, video does not cost you time. It compounds and makes you time. I cannot tell you how many times people say, hey, I got a question about a buy down, question about your doctor program, blah, blah, blah. And what I literally did starting my YouTube channel was took the 15-minute conversations I have with clients and business partners every day, formatted it into like an educational component. And I got this because I was trying to change a spare tire in my car and I didn't know how. And I watched YouTube 7 times and I got it. And I was like, you know, if anybody ever wanted to know how to change a spare tire, how to do a listing appointment, what is a 2-1 buy down, I could recreate that in a place of like, it would literally compound my time in the message. So whether I was sending it to a real estate partner, whether I was sending it to a client, these are things that over time, it won't cost you time. It will buy you time and compound the time. And then it comes down to like the brand, because you become the digital mayor of that space and you've done it for so long and people are so aware and you've built the trust that it can actually grow your brand, make you more money. And I think put you in a place of where if you were on vacation and, you know, somebody needed an explanation of A, B, and C, you could in theory say, hey, check out these 2 or 3 videos. Also for our team, if somebody calls in and has maybe some questions that are high level and some of the teams maybe not know how to answer it correctly, as opposed to misspeaking or pausing or doing whatever, saying, hey, here's a quick video from Julie about the 3 best ways to list your house and blah, blah, blah. Do me a favor, check this out in the meantime, and then I'm going to make a note for the appointment that she'll follow up with stuff here and there. It really does so much more for people than just actually, you know, do video content long term. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, but I do think once people get going and get rolling, like, I couldn't imagine not doing video now.
Oh, I couldn't even imagine. And just like you said, I think it was early on I realized that these social media channels, whether it's Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, whatever, they are your own media channel,
yep.
Right? And but I do think it requires a certain degree of responsibility and thoughtfulness about what you put out into that space.
100%.
And I think that kudos to the people who get to first base on that, but they do need to be just the same way we're talking about how do you grow a team. It's what is the thought and the intention behind it, and what is that brand? It has to be authentic to who you are as a person.
Correct.
But a gut check on what you're putting out there is important.
So important.
Right? And that's where if it doesn't feel right, don't do it. Right? don't do it. I mean, go forward with things that are helpful, educational, and professional, mm-hmm. right? And that's changed a lot too, because we have all these, the proliferation of all these TV shows, whether it's Selling Sunset or Million Dollar Listing. And there's some really good information in those too, but it also, it can seem very Kardashian-like, sure. right? And it looks like such an easy business where it's like, I like houses.
Right.
I have friends.
Yeah.
Right. And I think a lot of people will fake their way through this sort of luxury lifestyle.
Yeah.
Right. And I just think it can be really phony. So where I think the true power comes from for these agents who are on the sidelines thinking about getting in, it just comes to like, share what you know. You're an expert in the space already.
And be authentic. I mean, by misrepresenting on social media, I mean, it doesn't really do anything for you, the fake it part. It's a disservice to the client too. Like, how would you feel if there was a doctor that was putting all this stuff out and you were the first surgery and the person they cut on, right? It would be like, oh, kind of scary. So there's a proactive way to be somebody online. But I think in the early stages, be authentic. Like, talk about the fact that you're young and you may not have the experience that you have, but you can outwork anybody. Mm-hmm. And then talk about, hey, I did this apartment lease and I failed here and I did this loan, blah, blah, blah. I think that type of content, saying like, it's okay to fail, but just fail up and fail forward versus maybe the pretend piece here and there. Because as you know, buying or selling a house, I mean, it's the biggest investment and purchase of someone's life. You don't want somebody misrepresenting who they are out there in order to grab something that they're not really qualified for. It's okay to work their way up. And I think that's a great point, that people have to be authentic and professional because people are paying attention to it. What if you went online and looked at your lawyer or your doctor or your accountant and they were like in the bar ripping shots and doing stuff here and there? Like, we're all human. We all have our own lives. We're not saying don't not keep it real, but sometimes don't keep it so real, but make sure the real is also authentic to where it represents you, and understand like your people are going to look at you online. If they see this, what does it see? What does it feel like? What does it look like? And to your point, use your spotty sense. If there's any question there, the best thing is like, don't do it. Just pass on that and put out something more professional, which is good.
And leaning into too, like for people who aren't in the luxury sector and doing $100 million a year, right?
Right.
I think hustle matters so much.
Yeah.
So I would go for someone who really has that hustle in sure. them and that work ethic over someone who's maybe just gotten really accustomed and entitled
yeah.
to a certain line of business over the years. That hustle, I think, translates a lot. And you can, listen, when I first moved here, like I said, I didn't know a soul, right? I didn't even know where Preston or Hillcrest or I was figuring out, I don't understand this 35 E West. What does that even mean?
Sure.
Right. And you've got to get used to, you got to know your market, but I wouldn't exactly call it breaking and entering, but I would go into apartment buildings in Uptown and I would just make my way past the concierge and I would go into the mailrooms and I would get pictures of all the mailboxes mm-hmm. because that was the way that I knew that I could get a mailing list.
Of course.
And then I had a target audience of renters.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
That's a story. Right. And so just lean into what you know and what you're doing. And I think people will respond to that.
So break it into markets. That helps me transition to my next one. So you have a lot of luxury clients. Talk to me about, from taking pictures of apartment complex mailboxes to do mail outs to try to get clients, to dealing with multi-million dollar clients now and athletes and celebrities and all these things. What is that journey like? How big of a difference is it dealing with a luxury client versus an everyday first-time home buyer? What does that journey look like for you? And what's the biggest adjustments you've had to make when dealing with because you and I have done a $500,000 first-time home buyer, we've done a $3 million client, but for you personally, what was that journey like? How did you get into the luxury market?
I think you get into the luxury market, but it is a question of sort of baby steps and consistency, right? And as you age and as you grow, that also opens doors to different clientele, right? And so, pre-kids, when I was a young kid myself, I was attracting a lot of people in a similar stage of life. So some of it is a natural maturity and evolution.
Okay.
But I do think that in order to have the credibility, you do have to have some of the mileage too, to get into that top tier. And then once you break in, then there are no options for failure. You have to hustle and you have to focus on that luxury property because that needs to be a success story for you.
Totally.
And then the listings beget listings, right? And so that also, my signs out there do lead to more signs,
right?
But in terms of what's different behind the scenes, you might not like this answer. People might not like this answer, but it's the honest to goodness truth is that I really do treat that $500,000 buyer the same as the $5 million buyer.
Yeah.
And that goes down to the relationship aspect, right? Is that at the end of the day, I am trying to create an advocate out of that client. I need them to get not just to the closing table, but past the closing table, where they felt that I was such a tremendous, irreplaceable partner to them. Mm-hmm. And so that the biggest listing I ever have could come from that $500,000 buyer referring me to their parents or a rich aunt somewhere or whatever it may be, or their boss or what have you. So I'm very democratic behind the scenes in terms of the process and the attention I give, irrespective of price point. And that really is the truth. And that comes from the gut. And I think people feel that. And I also spend a lot of time probably talking people. I probably spend more time talking people out of houses as opposed to into them.
That's good.
And that also builds credibility. Smart. And they're like, and they can see what the intention is, and there's not an agenda there. It's doing a good job.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, because people come to us for sound advice, and sometimes the advice is no. People want to make a deal happen or want a loan or commission here and there. You can't be about that. And I think the older that you get, people appreciate that. And sometimes when I'm running budgets, I'm like, this is a little bit too much, or maybe you want to pay this off here and there. And again, it's not ideal. Most people would be like, hey, let me just help them get it taken care of. But what you want is you want that to turn into a success story, mm-hmm. not a horror story. And so when you lean in with the right advice, it always comes back around, whether it's to your point, small or big. I'm curious, on the luxury market, is there more impact, less impact, or nothing at all when it comes to social media and video? Like, does your $3 million client pay attention as much to who you are on TikTok and Instagram versus your $500,000 home buyer? Or are they more worried about, hey, I want good videos and like drone videos and stuff, or of the house? Like, does it mean as much and impact them as much that you have such a good video presence when you're taking care of a super high-end client, or that, or is it just case by case?
I mean, I think in this day and age of sort of like our swipe right economy, mm-hmm. right, that the photography is super important. So okay. even if we're talking about a $500,000 house, we put that house through a boot camp to make sure that everything's in the right place, the right bedding, the right pillows on the couch, all of that. So I hire a staging consultant on every listing to make sure that we're kind of ready for our debut moment. We're not mm-hmm. walking down the aisle to the altar in sweatpants.
It's good.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing sort of now. Will I use different photographers and a different team of people depending on the price point? Absolutely, yes. But I try and do editorial photography and video on every listing, right? So it might be a different crew depending on price point.
Yeah, yeah.
But we try, it's that presentation online of their asset that gets people to make an appointment and knock on the door, right? So I would say, so in terms of like TikTok and Instagram and all that, it's just trying to put the best foot forward.
Yeah, I got it. Do you think—
Does that answer the question
fairly? No, I just did not. Like, you know, your $3 million buyer that may be in their 40s, I don't know if they're scrolling through Instagram looking for real estate videos and trying to select who their agent is. They probably already have you as the relationship here and there. I find that maybe younger generation move up buyer here and there is a little more in tune with that, and may impact them to call you here and there. But I agree with the experience, the mileage, the high-end photography, all that stuff based on previous evidence success is probably more impactful to them.
But I do think it's your resume, right? I do think that those first six tiles or whatever it is, that is your photographic visual resume. And so hearing you talk, and when they can go on, someone might creep on my profile.
Of course.
You know what I mean? Just to kind of see what I'm all about. And do they like me and do they trust me? And if they like me and trust me, then I'm probably going to get an appointment.
Right.
Right.
And if they haven't met you yet, paying attention to you online from a digital interview standpoint, people are attracted to that piece. And I think that's where it's super duper important that you have that. But whether it be high end or low end, if they're trying to make a decision between A and B, and they're the exact same guy or girl, but A does not have a social presence and B does, 100 out of 100, they're going to go check you out and be like, I like her. And that could be the difference of tipping the scale and saying like, okay, now I get it.
And so my dad recently just sold a property just outside of Sarasota. And he asked, he was like, do you have any agents I should interview? And I went straight there, right? I went straight there. And it is shocking, actually, how unimpressive the vast majority of agents' social media is.
I know.
It's so bad. And that is really a first stop for people to kind of research. And we bought a property in Northwest Arkansas a couple of years ago in Bentonville. Mm. Same thing. I'm like, listen, I know the business of real estate, but I don't know that particular market.
Yeah.
And I need someone to help me with the value nuances and identifying and creating opportunities. So I went online. And it was so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it was actually really insightful to be an agent and look for an agent in another market.
Correct.
And it was, it just, it, it, it gave me some perspective also on how consumers see agents.
Correct.
And because, like we talk about, it is such a low bar, mm-hmm. right? It's pretty easy
sure.
to be great.
Correct.
By doing what you say you're going to do and by doing professional branding
and just knowing your stuff. Representing that well online. I agree. I mean, if you think your industry's rough, mine's even worse when it comes to like how mortgage people look online. It's one of the reasons in late 18 and 19 where I just said, like, there is more to my industry than what people think. It's not somebody's old dad in a red tie in the corner of Wells Fargo and a bank on a cherry desk or whatever. Like, there's more to it. And I've tried to put it together in a way that people would take it, you know, change the articulation, break the status quo, nugget stuff here and there. But to your point, you look up mortgage or realtor in these random places and the bar is so low, which for me as a, you know, a thought leader, it's like, why wouldn't somebody see, hey, this is my competition, go get it, which obviously you have done. But I do think like just having that bold presence and being authentic in the resume online, it pops to the top. And whoever pops at the top, you're going to have the first opportunity to at least try to maybe capture that opportunity with a client.
And I think that will be even more important going forward.
Yes.
With this NAR proposed settlement and all of that, is that I do think we are going to flush out a lot of people in the market who frankly deserve to be fleshed mm-hmm. out. It's going to be a culling of the herd, so to speak.
For sure.
Because again, some of these shows and everything, a lot of people ushered in and they have been overpaid and underperformed. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that that will leave the business owners, the people who really run their businesses like businesses, yep. those will be the people that are left standing. And also with some of this talk in terms of commission and all that, especially on the buy side, I'm curious to see how it shakes out in terms of what, you know, what really, really changes versus yep. moving compensation from page 11 to page 9 sure. and so on. But the one thing that I do think could be really positive about this evolution that we're going through right sure. now, a general cleanup of the industry, because I think the consumer does deserve that. A consumer does not deserve someone
totally agree.
Who's a part-timer.
Totally
they
agree.
Just don't. That's dangerous, actually. And second, I also think it's a real opportunity just to differentiate yourself, mm-hmm. right? As someone who really knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
But I do think that the one thing where we talk about NAR and moving that buyer compensation in terms of buyer representation agreements,
yeah.
those have to be at the beginning of someone's searches, which the truth is smart agents who are running their businesses like businesses, we're getting those anyways.
Sure.
That if you weren't, you were doing volunteer work. Whether you know it or not,
yeah.
if you didn't have that representation agreement in place. But now that it's going to be mandated that that's at the front end, the one thing I'm curious to see is before you might, I'm not saying you personally, yeah. but a buyer might pick an agent because it's like, oh, my brother's girlfriend just got her license,
mm-hmm.
right? But if the buyer starts sharing in a small percentage, I still think it's sellers in a seller's best interest to offer incentives for buyer compensation.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that most sellers will continue to offer to offset a portion of that. But to the extent that a buyer does have some financial obligation
correct.
To pay their own agent,
sure.
maybe they get smarter about who they hire.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that it's not you know, some bimbo or himbo that they saw on Instagram.
Well, and I think that's good. I mean, you talked about evolve or die. The industry is always evolving. Sometimes it's proactively, sometimes it's reactively. I think that happened during the subprime crash. It happened on the lender side in 2010 to 12 when they changed, you know, Dodd-Frank, they changed our compensation. And then it went from being like everybody could get a loan to nobody could get a loan because it was super hard. So it naturally squeezed itself out. But the truth is our industry, except for maybe a year, has been an incredible run for the past decade. And this new NAR stuff, I want to spend a little time on it because obviously it affects your side a lot more than my side. It will affect me down the line, but I agree the opportunity for it to refresh and reset and get out the people that don't belong. I want to talk about, you know, for you specifically, because you already represent buyers, sellers, you have a ton of experience. I know there's a lot that still has to shake out. The GSEs on my side, Fannie, Freddie, FHA, HUD, they haven't mentioned a word about it because it affects closing costs and all these things. But do you think the biggest, assuming things kind of fall in line like they're supposed to, is the biggest change going to be the buyer's decision-making on who they actually agree to represent them? Is it the sellers on how much they're going to pay? Is it the structure of how it's done? Obviously, the loan piece has a lot to do with that, which I'll talk about in a minute. But for you, where do you see the biggest shift?
So that's a great question. I'm still processing it
right.
because it all just happened. But I do think that conversations up front at the front end are going to be more important, okay, whether it's with your buyer or your seller. So I'm saying it from a standpoint of an agent, right? Mm. When I'm getting together with a buyer, it really is, I want to be really clear about what the compensation looks like. Mm-hmm. And that is, let's say in my case, to represent you as a buyer, it's 3% of the purchase price. Now, we are going to work to get the seller, as part of our overall deal, we will work to get the seller to offset that cost in terms of a closing cost credit, mm-hmm, right? But there's the possibility that there could be a percentage that you owe. And if the seller is not willing to participate at all in terms of covering that cost, it's going to be your decision as a buyer whether to pursue that property or not,
yeah,
or whether that takes it, that makes it financially not a feasible option for us, mm, right? But you have to have those conversations with the buyers on the front end, mm, right?
Got it.
So that's on the buy side. On the seller side, I'm going to be encouraging my sellers to offer that incentive, right? Because I think it's a question, you've got two doors. You've got door number one to self-represented buyers. And let's make no mistake about this. Can people do it successfully? Yes, they can. But let's also be real about getting from point A to point B. A self-represented buyer probably has a 60 to 70% chance of falling apart.
Sure.
They do not understand the business of real estate and what's normal, what's considered market. So take an example like this with an unrepresented buyer. You go under contract with them. They hire some inspector off Google. Sounds like mistake number one,
yep,
right?
Yep.
They go ahead and get that. And then they want to negotiate repairs. So instead of negotiating actual repairs, they're like, you know what? I came through and I kind of think that this place needs painting, you know? So I'd like $35,000 for painting. It's like, that's cosmetic stuff, dummy. Sure. We're not doing that,
right?
And so there's all these potential sort of hidden booby traps along the way from point A to point B with an unrepresented buyer. And everyone gets so horny about commission,
sure,
but really it is getting in a car with square tires.
Right.
And you can't act surprised then when it's a bumpy road to closing.
Sure.
You can't.
Yeah.
And so that's your option, depending on what you as a seller choose to offer as incentives to attract people to your listing and to, mm-hmm, your asset. Behind door number two is financially vetted and qualified buyers who are working with a professional to help tell them what the process is and quarterback that file. That it's a question what your risk tolerance is,
yeah,
right? And at the end of the day, that is going to be the seller's decision. And you want to know what the truth is, Brian? You know this, I know this. It always has been. That's what's driven me crazy about the clickbait headlines,
sure,
about the end of this commission and this, that, and the other. It was like, what irresponsible journalism, where it has always been negotiable.
Sure.
Commissions have always been
correct,
negotiable. But take some ownership as a seller that what you choose to do on that end attracts a different audience.
Right.
Right?
Well, I mean, and the headlines are not about who's right, it's who's first. Even if it's bad information, which stinks, but then obviously, you know, you got to go back and defend it. I think to your point, what I my gut instinct on this is, and you hit all this and articulated it well, is that your commission is going to equal your value. Your value is based on your resume. And if you don't know all the ins and outs, and you don't have experience, and you don't have the inspector, you don't have the lender, you don't have the title company, you don't have the attorney, you don't have all the ins and outs, then you don't have the value in order to articulate the commission that you're going to ask to be paid for. And the buyer won't be able to feel it, because price is only an issue when value isn't clear. And so your 3%, it doesn't come as a natural for everybody just because, and to your point, it always was negotiable, but it was almost like it was a standard that was built in. So now if the buyer has to choose and they end up maybe having to pay, you know, if they are speed dating three people and saying like, well, I've got to give a commission A, B, and C, and you've got to put that together, I do think that it will clean up the industry. I do think there are people on my side and your side that don't belong. And if they, you know, can't adjust with this evolution, so be it, but it's for the greater good piece. The part that I wonder about too is, you know, for fun and games, what happens if the buyer has to pay and they don't pay you? Mm-hmm. Does the realtor take them to court? Do they sue them? Is there a judgment? Do you spend more on attorney fees trying to get the commission? Do you let it go? What does the broker do? There are all these crazy things, because you've got a lawsuit that's a federal lawsuit, but then you have 50 states and each individual state. Then you have mortgage guidelines that says like, well, maybe the seller wants to give a closing cost credit to the buyer. Well, and then the buyer takes that money and maybe pays the buyer's agent to get it all done. Well, what happens if it's a loan product that doesn't allow for that much of a closing cost? Yeah. So then they can't actually do it. Or what about the VA buyer, when veterans are literally not allowed to pay anything? So even if it's built in and you give the buyer a credit, the veteran can't technically be charged or paid, period. So these variables are all gonna have to
work. And appraisals.
Correct. Right. And all these things are going to have to be worked out up front. And so I don't know where it's going to settle. I think things like this get, I think corrections are good. I think the people that belong can be excited about it. Because it gives you the ability, like the mortgage space, there is an article up to 63% have gotten out in the last 24 months. And people ask me like, you know, weren't you worried about this? I'm like, no, dude, I made the subprime crash my 20th year. Like, thank goodness this month we had like 26 families help for 18 million. But I also say like people that have a lot of muscle in the industry, meaning they're really good at what they do, in really hard times, they have the ability to show their muscle a lot more. When rates are at 299 at COVID, dude, anybody could do a loan, sell a house, the fish are jumping in the boat. But once all that good goes away and there's a storm, when people don't have a lot of skill sets and they don't have a lot of capacity to take on a lot of clients and can't get past first base, those are the ones that have the struggles. Those are the ones that fall off. But I think respectfully, that's okay, because the client wants the person that can hit a home run and a grand slam, not just a single. And I think some of this lawsuit, depending upon where it settles, will flush some of that out. And I think the people that belong and that are in it will actually capture more of the market share.
100% agree. And I think that we are due for a cleanup. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's a really positive evolution of all this and an outcome of all this. But I do have some legitimate concerns, mostly for the first-time home buyer.
I do.
What that person is trying to do is they're trying to get on the first rung of the wealth ladder, yep. Right? And the first rung. And where I heard this, I wish I knew who to credit it to, but it was a quote that I saw somewhere online where someone said, the concern about all this is that when you remove humans from the real estate, the residential process, right? Sure. Especially at the first-time home buyer level, you do pave way for AI and private equity and displacement, just sure. General displacement that I just think, but it's being packaged, interestingly enough, as mm-hmm. a win for the consumer. And I don't know that I'm 100% convinced on that.
I agree. I think the people that need the most help sometimes in these scenarios, directly or indirectly, the ones that get punished the most because they need the most help. People that are going to do 3% down, 5% down, VA 100%, even down payment assistance, to just jumpstart to get things going, they can be affected a lot more because they have less capital, they have less bandwidth to move things around, debt payoff restrictions, all this. And so to your point, the way it's being designed and pitched to the public, it's not a benefit for all. And I think the people that need it the most might be the ones that suffer the most, even though it appears as if they're saving money, but it's actually costing them.
I think so too. And like I said, I think it's a misrepresentation as a win. And I think there are some good things that will come out of it, but I think there are going to be people that are hurt in the process too.
Yeah, I agree. Well, listen, this has been an amazing time with you. As always, you're just super educational. You inspire me. You've done so much, and I'm thankful to have you as a friend and a business partner. Before we get out of here, if people want to find you, connect with you, have you helped them, represent them, talk about social, website, where can they find you?
Sure. So JulieProvenzanoGroup.com is my website. On Instagram, it's Julie Provenzano Group with underscores in between each. And nice. That's my Instagram. And then the spicy stuff is on TikTok.
There you go.
It's still very professional.
Yeah.
But I push the limits a little more there with some cold, hard truth mm-hmm. that I don't as much on Instagram. Instagram, I kind of keep it a little bit more simple.
Yeah.
But TikTok, I let it out there.
Good. So. You got to let it rip. TikTok's the one you can let a little more emotion on because it's fun and you can have it and keep it professional. But yeah, it's a good time. So listen, you guys go find her online. She's amazing. If you need her help representing folks, clients, whatever, education, even looking to grow her team, Julie is one of the best around town. I promise you, she will not let you down. Follow her, like her, subscribe. She's amazing. For everybody out there, thanks so much for tuning in. We appreciate you. We are on YouTube, Apple, everything under the sun. You can live subscribe as well. Until next time, stay tuned. Thank you.